Welcome back to the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux, and today I am joined by Matt Corey for episode 22. Matt, how's it going?
Doing good. Just turning off my cell phone ringer so I don't, because, you know, I'm really popular. I get lots of phone calls.
Well, you are figuring out all of your Little League plans, so that is to be expected. So we'll forgive you for that.
I appreciate it.
For all of you who are unfamiliar with Matt Corey, he is a regular guest of ours. He also writes at PP Boston and Vice Sports, and you can find him at his excellent Twitter handle, at MattyMatty2000. It does seem like it's been a long time since we've had you on the show because, you know, the rotation got muddled a little bit with Ben and I traveling, and then, you know, all sorts of things led to about a month and a half since you've been on. So certainly a ton to talk about, and a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get right into it.
Well, Red Sox did something that they've been doing too often for most people who watch the team. Last night, they lost a 2-1 game to the Padres, who aren't very good. They're in the last place club, one of the worst clubs in baseball. This was particularly disturbing because it was coming off of a 1-0 loss to the Athletics, where Eddie Rodriguez nearly threw a no-hitter, and they still lost that game. So with the division right there for the taking, these one-run losses are becoming increasingly frustrating. And there's this whole narrative brewing out there that the Red Sox are terrible in one-run games, bad against weak opponents, and possibly even unclutch. So what we're going to do today on the show is look at all these things and kind of distill out what's really true about some of these narratives that have been out there and what isn't. So the first one I want to tackle is the Red Sox record in one-run games, because to be honest, it really hasn't been that bad. So far this year, the Red Sox are 16-20 in one-run games. To give you an idea of where some of the other teams that they're competing against in the division are in those particular situations, Toronto's actually worse. They're at 15-22 in one-run games. Baltimore is slightly better at 15-13, so winning record there. Tampa Bay is terrible in all types of games, so they are not surprisingly very bad at 11-20. The Yankees, you know, are the only team in the division that has a really good record in that regard, though.
The crazy thing about Tampa Bay is they've been really good the second half. Like, they were just horrific in the beginning. But I actually don't even have their stats in front of them, but I looked at it the other day, and I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, they're actually kind of the team we expected them to be in the second half.
Yeah, you know, I always thought that they had more talent than they were showing this year. So I guess that's not all that surprising to me. That club seemed to have a lot more in terms of pitching and good young hitting than – they sort of showed on the field for most of the year. And one of the big parts of that team performing and actually killing the Red Sox too, which isn't necessarily true, but the Red Sox have played them enough times that there have been three or four losses that certainly could have gone the Red Sox way.
Yeah.
And I think in at least two of those contests, Evan Longoria was solely responsible for those losses.
You know, he's their lone really good player. I mean, position player, but
well, Kiermaier's pretty good, too.
He's really, really good defensively. I don't think he's a great hitter.
No, but we're going off of, like, win probability added to his team, I think you still have to regard him as a solid plus.
Well, so we can use that. Oh, yeah, he's definitely a plus. Yeah. I'd much rather have Jackie Bradley. But in any case, as far as the Rays go, their first half, according to, I'm not sure where Baseball Reference breaks this up. If it's literally, I think it has to be the All-Star break because of the numbers.
It is, yeah.
Okay, so the quote unquote first half before the All-Star break, the Rays went 34-54, and the second half they've gone 24-24, which is not great, but they've actually outscored their opponents by 32+21, which is 53. So they've way underperformed their Pythagorean record in that respect. So in any case, they are a tougher out now than they were back then. I think it's pretty safe to say that.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you on that regard. What was interesting, though, is sorting through all of these one-run records through baseball, because a few different places have that listed out for every single team under expanded standings, so you can easily find that information online. I have trouble believing that one-run game records is all that indicative of how good a team is, especially when I'm looking at the records of some of these teams like the Chicago Cubs are 21-20 in one-run games, and yep. St. Louis is 20-20 in one-run games. The Dodgers also leading their division, 19-18. It seems like, you know, by and large, it's not that big of a deal. And then you have a team like Philadelphia, who's one of the worst teams in baseball at 25-18 in these contests. So I think people are putting way too much stock in this as a huge weakness for the Red Sox. I think that as we get into the other two things that we'll talk about, the unclutchness of the team and their record against weaker opponents, this might be the thing that I'm least worried about out of those three things.
Yes, on the whole, I absolutely agree. On the whole, you know, the Red Sox, problem, quote unquote, with one run games is really not much of a problem, at least I would say statistically. I mean, studies have shown the way teams perform in one run games is essentially random. I say essentially because I think there are some indicators for how you perform in one run games. Like you can improve the way you, the way you play close games with a good bullpen. My guess is a guess, but if you have a really strong defense, that probably improves it. But that said, it's not necessarily something that, great teams don't perform well in one-run games any better than you would expect them to, i.e. around 500. The Yankees are 22-9, and they're six games over 500 right now. You mentioned the Phillies. That's the other, sort of easy one. They're 25-18. The Arizona is 19-12. There's nothing special about these teams that makes them quote unquote good in one run games. I would say as far as the Red Sox go, we've certainly here on the podcast at BP Boston and just about everywhere else, talked about their bullpen till we're blue in the face. And I think, probably with good reason considering how good the rest of the team is. But if they're not very strong in one-run games and you want to figure out a way to improve the team in that respect, I would say improving the bullpen would be the way to do that. And the Red Sox, there are still some ways that can happen outside of sort of, random Matt Barnes improvement. Right. Koji's coming back. That could be helpful. It probably won't hurt them. You mentioned Joe Kelly. I can't recall if you mentioned Joe Kelly on air or just somewhere else, but
we did talk about him potentially coming back and being an impact player down the stretch last week.
Yeah.
And we'll get into his performance last night later in the show, but certainly there we have something that could potentially be a boon to the team.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is nothing is certain with Joe Kelly.
Joe Kelly's sure. Middle name is maybe.
I thought it was Suck.
I guess it depends on who you're talking to. But it is sort of interesting to look at one run records and go, okay, well, if this really isn't indicative of talent, then you can look at a team like the Texas Rangers and go, they're 82-56, which is the best record in the American League, but they're also 30-9 in one run games. The word luck is thrown around a lot, and I'm, in casual conversation, I guess it's okay. If you look at their Pythagorean record, if you look at their record in one run games, it doesn't seem like the Rangers are nearly as good a team as you know, their regular record indicates.
I think we'd agree with that, though, based on the play on the field. And when you break down their roster, they've had a lot of guys who have had, and we'll get into this more as we go on. I don't want to give away too much of the clutch stuff that we'll talk about, but like Adrian Beltre has been one of the most clutch players in all of baseball this year. And they've had a lot of players that have had extremely clutch performances. I believe their team as a whole rates as the most clutch hitting team in the league.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so I'm just, it's hard to distill out really how much of that is luck and how much isn't. But I think the Pythagorean record there that you referenced really does show a little bit of a better snapshot of what their true talent level is as a team rather than this semi-fluky, extremely good run in one-run games. And the fact that they've even had that many one-run games in itself might be a little indicative of their team talent as well.
Yes. The one caveat to that is, you know, the additions they made at the trade deadline. You know, Jonathan Lucroy is for real. They added somebody else who's good too, and I'm blanking on who it is.
It's not Carlos Gomez.
Carlos Beltran, though.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of.
The
better Carlos. The
one that. Isn't that amazing to say, considering Gomez was like an MVP caliber player for a number of years and is still relatively young, and Beltran's like 1,000 and still better?
Well, but Beltran was really bad last year, which, you know, I think was because he was injured most of the year. But yeah, last year we probably, if you'd said the good Carlos, you might have been referring to Carlos Gomez. So yeah, it changes. It's baseball. It's weird.
Do you put any more stock in a team's record in extra innings more than you do in one run performance, or do you kind of lump that in as very similar contextually? I think I put a little bit more stock in a team's extra innings record, because I think managers today tend to manage that a little bit more aggressively.
It's an interesting question, and I imagine there is an empirical answer. I think I've used that word right, but I might not have. but I believe there is an answer that is correct, but I don't know what it is. My guess, though, is that it probably is mostly statistical noise, because especially when you're talking, like if you look at the Red Sox, they've played, 130 games at this point. 10 of them have gone into extra innings.
Right.
You know, and, you know, when you're talking about how, you know, the teams, you know, basically regress to a 500 record in one run games, you know, you're talking about 10 games. Most of those are probably one run games. My guess is that most of it's just sort of randomness, almost like with any 10 game sample of the season.
I'll tell you what has me questioning that, though, is, you know, three of the managers that I'll take as three of the best managers in the game, and I don't think many people would argue this point. We got Bochy out in San Francisco, Madden in Chicago, and Buck in Baltimore. All three of those teams have winning records in extra innings. Baltimore's 5-2 over that span. The Cubs are 8-4, and San Francisco's 9-7. So, and that is different from how some of the other division leading teams and some of those that have notoriously bad managers, by historical standpoint. I mean, we talk about people complaining about Dusty Baker's usage of pretty much everybody. And his record this year has been 4-6 in extra inning games. The Dodgers record 5-7. So there's a little bit more there for me to kind of scratch my head at.
Okay. I'm not really seeing it, but okay.
Well, you know, we're here to start the discussion on it. So there's definitely something there that we need to do a little bit more research into. But let's get into this whole notion of the Red Sox performing poorly against bad teams. So far this year, the Red Sox have played, you know, a ton of opponents. I don't know how many exactly, but they only have had a losing record against the Chicago White Sox, the Detroit Tigers, the Kansas City Royals, the LA Dodgers, and the Toronto Blue Jays. Two of those clubs that I mentioned, they've played just a few times. Toronto, they're 6-7 against this year, so that's pretty close in its own right. The Kansas City Royals, they're 2-4 against, but you know they're a World Series team from the last 2 years, so I think they play a particularly tough brand of baseball for the Red Sox as well. And what I'm noticing here is that there's not a whole lot to back up the fact that the Red Sox don't beat up on teams with losing records, because they've done so against teams like Atlanta, against Colorado, you know, teams like the LA Angels. They're 4-3 against, so I guess there is a little bit of a weakness there. They don't dominate these bad opponents, but they've certainly still been winning the season series against them. So I'm wondering where you think this notion that they can't perform against sub 500 teams come from.
I think it's mostly, you know, selective memory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to look at individual games like last night's, you know, and cat, don't scratch me. I'm trying to talk. And, you know, get discouraged. But it's all so random, you know, on a single game basis, on a small, you know, sample size. I feel like I'm repeating myself, not giving you a lot of good information, but I keep coming back to that. Like, you know, the home run that, who hit the 2-run homer yesterday for the Padres? Not Gonzalez. I can't think of his name.
I'm blanking on it.
Rosales. Rosales.
Yeah, that's it.
Who doesn't hit home runs, by the way? But you know, who got a meatball and it made it over Brock Holt's glove by what, 6 inches?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, bounced off of the hands of the guy right behind the first row and into the head of the woman sitting next to him. So that was funny. But, you know, you're talking about a gust of wind, changing that from a two-run homer to an out, and then you're talking about a Red Sox win. So, I mean, would it be nice for the Red Sox to go and beat up on the A's, like, or beat up on other teams like they've beaten up on the A's? Yeah, it would be great. But that's obviously, you know, not really realistic.
Baseball is one of those sports, though, that you can't expect the same success against bad teams as you can in other sports like hockey or like football or anything, because there is so much randomness from day to day and fluctuation in individual player performance, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct and well said. So while we've been chatting, I did a little table here. Boy, I don't know what team that is. Let me see. Arizona. There we go. So Arizona, Minnesota, the Chicago White Sox, the Oakland A's, the Atlanta Braves, the San Diego Padres, the Tampa Bay Rays, and the Anaheim Angels. All those teams are terrible as far as the season goes, more or less, right?
Yep. All have terrible records. If not last place, they're right next to them.
Okay. Let's see.
I believe they are actually all in last place.
Yeah, they're all close. Well, I don't think they can all be in last place. I don't think the White Sox are they? I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is they're all terrible, and the Red Sox so far. Sorry?
White Sox are second to last in their division.
Okay, there you go.
Yep.
Because they're in the same division as the Twins, so they couldn't possibly be last. The Red Sox have gone 31-20 against all those teams, which is a 608 winning percentage. Which, let's see, 608 times 162, that's a 98 win pace.
That's pretty good.
There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think you could look at the Red Sox and go, this is a strong team in a number of areas. They've, you know, they maybe improved over the course of the season based on, you know, adding Benintendi, adding Pomerantz, that kind of thing. But they're not a 98 win team.
Right.
I don't think.
I don't think so either. We haven't seen that sort of dominance. We see that reflected in the weakness in the bullpen, which we'll discuss a little bit more in the future. And then the first half weakness of the starting pitching, no matter how well the starters have been playing since August started, you know, we still have those 4 months to account for, where starting pitching was just a giant question mark for this club.
Right. And the starting pitching has come around.
Yeah, it's great now.
Yeah, I wrote a piece at BP Boston about how, you know, provided they stay healthy, the rotation is actually looking pretty strong. So I think that's not as much of an issue. We can talk about, you know, how Stephen Wright, you know, his injury potentially impacts things. And I think that's on our agenda, so we may do that. But in any case, getting back to this or finishing this up, the Red Sox record against bad teams is actually really good. They've been really good against bad teams. And my guess is that they will win one or two more against San Diego today and tomorrow. I guess we'll know that by the time this comes out. Mm-hmm. Please don't let them get swept by the Padres.
That would be a disaster, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But in any case, I think, you know, if you look at all their sort of micro records against bad teams, against, you know, one run games, extra innings, et cetera, I think they are, a good team, demonstrably a good team, and not a great team. And everything kind of leads you back to that, to that kind of conclusion.
Yeah, if this were an episode of MythBusters, so far we would be 0-2 with these things panning out. So false that they are bad against bad opponents, and also false that they are a demonstrably more worse team in one-run games than really any other club that is in contention. So,
can I throw one more thing in there, Jake?
Sure, sure.
So. You brought up something with the Orioles before about how they are have been better in one-run games, I think.
In extra innings as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think that's what you said, is extra innings. I think that when you're comparing teams over the course of of season stats, it's easy to to say the things that we've said. However, when you're talking about a 5 or 7 game matchup, the Red Sox versus the Orioles, the Red Sox versus the Blue Jays, then you can be a lot more, I think, specific. And there's certainly a lot of randomness in a small matchup like that. But I think you can give one team an advantage, you know, in a bullpen kind of setting like that, and that can be a little more legitimate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get into this clutch and unclutch stuff because I think you did a really good job in your recent article explaining the Red Sox pitching woes in high leverage situations. Fangraphs has a couple really cool stats out regarding teams' clutchness. They can measure the clutchness of both pitching and hitting and individual pitchers and hitters. And this is basically a stat that has to do with leverage index, which quantifies sort of the pressure that is in any given situation. Also uses win probability added, the change in win expectancy from one plate appearance to the next. Close games, crucial situations like that are measured. So essentially, you know, it's not going to weigh a blowout the same as it will a one-run game or a tie game with two men on and, you know, men in scoring position, things like that. So they essentially divide those two to get something called context neutral wins. Without getting too crazy here into specifics, we're basically trying to figure out exactly how well individuals and teams have performed in situations where the pressure is turned up and where teams' win probability will go up if they do perform. And in these situations, the Red Sox have been really, really terrible in terms of pitching and hitting. And individually, there's one guy who, when I sorted through these stats and found out that he was among the worst clutch hitters in all of baseball, I just laughed because I've been screaming at my TV about how unclutch this particular player was for pretty much the entire season, and it reared its head again yesterday. So this will be a really fun conversation to have. So let's start off with the pitching. Red Sox are currently second to last in all of baseball in high leverage situations with a 12.42 ERA. Second only to the Arizona Diamondbacks in this regard. So, Matt, maybe you can talk about kind of what goes into measuring these high leverage situations and then what this really means for the team.
Well, I think I'm not sure what goes into measuring it, to be honest with you. But as far – well, I should point out also that you know, the range of ERAs, you mentioned the Red Sox have a 12.43 ERA in high leverage situations, which sounds absolutely abysmal, and it is.
Sure.
The team that is the best in baseball in this category is the Cubs, and they have a 6.53 ERA.
Right. So you've got men on base in these situations. You've got all sorts of things going on. So it's not at all surprising that all clubs would perform poorly in these situations.
Right. You know, that said, I think this goes to a couple things. This goes to the problems the Red Sox have had in the bullpen. You know, the people calling for John Farrell's head every time he leaves a pitcher out there one or two batters too long. This speaks to that a little bit. I think there's a little bit of credence to that argument, based on this. And you know, there's also the counter argument, which is, well, those guys have to just pitch better.
Right.
You know, and you know, they're major leaguers and at some point you have to step up and get the job done. And it's not all John Farrell's fault. So I think there's something to that argument as well. I mean, you know, we've seen pitchers cruising along into the eighth inning, and you know, David Price has done it, I want to say, a couple times where he, you know, he goes along to the eighth and then just comes apart in a series of like six or nine pitches. You know, walk, double, home run, double. Whoa, there you go, game over. You know.
Yeah. We saw that a bunch from Price in the first half, and we saw that from Clay Buchholz and Eddie Rodriguez every time they pitched, it seemed like, in the first half as well. So it was
right. It
was a team-wide disease that was not shared by just Stephen Wright at that point, and now he has it. So it's been really bad.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. The other thing I would say about this is I'm not sure it's indicative of talent. So I don't necessarily think, you know, like we were talking about with the one run games thing. I don't think this is some irredeemable character flaw in the Red Sox. Last year, the Red Sox had a similar team, right? More or less.
Yeah.
A little different for sure, but a similar roster. And they had an 8.21 ERA in these situations, which was eighth in baseball. I'm not sure that they did anything to make themselves, you know, into the worst in baseball by adding David Price, by adding Pomerantz. I think sometimes these things just kind of happen.
I wonder what the correlation is between this stat and bullpen ERA, how strong that maybe that R squared value would be if you were to kind of measure these guys.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the problem also with bullpen ERA is a lot of times, like we've seen it with Matt Barnes, he comes in and, well, not as much recently, but over the course of the year, we've heard how Matt Barnes is great at not allowing inherited runners to score.
Ha! I was there on Sunday.
Yeah, right. So I don't necessarily think, you know, and at the same time, Matt Barnes has like a 4 or something ERA. So I don't think that there's necessarily anything. to that. I think over a long period of time, good relievers are going to get more guys out and give up less hard contact, and fewer inherited runners will score. But on a small sample size, which is, I think, the theme of this podcast so far, almost any number of different things can happen. And I tend to think that this is along the lines of that kind of thing. Go ahead.
I do think that this indictment of the team in high leverage situations, though, is certainly something that people who follow the team on a day-to-day basis and have watched the team throughout the year to, you know, a lot of frustration, can finally point to and say, like, ha, I knew this was happening more than it should be. Because despite the team having, like, a really good season, there have been so many situations that you can point to over the course of the year where, they were maybe one pitch away from getting out of the inning or one batter away from leaving the three runners on base instead of having them score. And in all of these situations, it seems like, or in a lot of them, there has been the game on the line. This hasn't been blowout type situations where we've seen this happening. It's been in really close context contests. And I think that this stat is so good because it does measure the leverage of these situations, and it does measure the win probability added had things gone the opposite way in these situations. So what this does to me is it shows that the Red Sox have been dealing with a lot of these things, and whether or not that's more indicative of true talent level of the pitchers or whether it's small sample size bad luck in a lot of these situations, regardless of what the culprit is there, it has been happening. And this does prove that to us, which is, I think, something in itself. You know, that's something to talk about there.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you've watched a lot of the Red Sox games this year, you know, they definitely, you know, have the feel of an unclutch team. They've come up, on the wrong side of a lot of those sort of situations where, you know, Ortiz comes up with a guy at third and two outs in the ninth and pops out. I mean, that's not to pick on Ortiz, although he does come up as one of the most unclutch player hitters on the team, shockingly enough. But there have been, it seems, an awful lot of those. And I really can't recall very many, like, game-winning hits. I think the Red Sox have like two this year. It's been an incredibly infrequent event, especially, you know, over the last couple months. But I think as far as, you know, if you're looking at playoff matchups, if you're looking at how the teams, match up in the AL East going into the September run to see if we make the playoffs, I think looking at something, you know, as far as pitchers go, like DRA, you know, is a much better indicator of, where the quality of the team is than looking at something like clutch. I would much rather play, you know, the Texas Rangers, who have been incredibly clutch this year, than I would the Toronto Blue Jays, who have actually been more unclutched than the Red Sox. And maybe you would disagree with that, and I think that's totally fine. There can be a discussion about that, but I think I would rather take a chance against the team that is not as good. So I
actually agree with you, Matt. I would also rather play the teams that have the better clutch records than teams that have the better Pythagorean records, because when you do look at it, you know, the Red Sox have one of the better Pythagorean records in the league right now at 81-56, the expected record, where a team like Texas, who's been notoriously clutch, like you mentioned, their record's only 71-67 in such situations. So I do agree that that's a better metric of how much talent the team has than their performance in these one-run games. But still very interesting about the high leverage situations there. I wanted to talk about where the Red Sox actually factor in, though, in hitting as well. They're second to last in the league in clutch hitting, or I'm sorry, they're 23rd in the league in clutch hitting as well, at -3.63 as a whole, which I thought was interesting considering how good the offense has been this year. But there have been a few players on the team, when we break this down by individual, that have not been performing very well in the clutch. And two of these guys that I'll talk about right off the bat are Mookie Betts and David Ortiz, which in these high leverage situations have rated as poor or below average players so far this season in those situations, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I don't know what you say about it. I would think that, you know, given enough chances, David Ortiz is going to come through more times than not. You know, we've certainly seen that throughout his career, and he's been such an excellent player this year that it seems – I mean, put it this way. You know that David Ortiz has been the second worst? No, there's another page here. Yep, Jackie Bradley has been the worst. And somehow that's not surprising. The third worst in clutch situations this season, David Ortiz. So I'll give you the choice, Jake. So the Red Sox are down 2-1. There's a runner at second, two outs in the ninth. You can have Ryan Hannigan, who is the third most clutch player on the Red Sox this year, or you can have David Ortiz, who is the third least.
Yeah, that is not even a question. Obviously, we're going to go with David Ortiz there in that situation. Yeah. I just thought it was kind of interesting where some of these players ended up so far this year, and I think there's a lot of that is small sample size. So Dustin Pedroia and Xander Bogaerts are two of the most clutch players on the team. But nobody really falls way, way outside of the norms here. Everybody on the team, aside from Sandy Leon and Jackie Bradley, fall within 1 point of what is essentially average, what is essentially normal for a clutch player. So there have been most of the guys, including David Ortiz at the near the bottom of this list and Dustin Pedroia at the top, have been mostly within range of average. Sandy Leon has been slightly worse at -1.11, but Jackie Bradley Jr. has completely broken the scale here. Anything below -2.0 or more is considered awful by this standard. Jackie Bradley comes in at 2.29, which is just stunningly bad, and he has been absolutely pathetic in these types of clutch situations. We saw it again yesterday. Anytime it seems like that he gets up in an important situation, men on base, men in scoring position, one out, all he has to do is lift the ball or like not strike out. He does the most awful thing that he can do in that situation, whether it's striking out or hitting into a double play. I'm not sure why the bat is still in his hands with these situations, especially late in games. There were some people clamoring as to why he was even up in that situation yesterday and why that the guy replaced was Yoan Moncada instead of him. We can argue that point till we're blue in the face, but Jackie Bradley seems to be notoriously unclutch, and it's not just something that we're seeing. It's a real thing this year.
He's certainly failed in a lot of important situations, but again, I would say I don't necessarily think that that is indicative of who he is as a player. You know, these things kind of bounce around, and you know, no one would call David Ortiz unclutch except that he actually has been this year. On the whole, you know, Jackie Bradley is right now he's hitting .272 with a .350 on base percentage, and he's slugging .495. You know, he's a streaky hitter. Maybe these things have come up, you know, kind of at the wrong time for him when he's been slumping. I mean, they're kind of randomly sprinkled throughout. I mean, we see that kind of thing with scheduling too, right? Like where the Red Sox end up playing a team right when they're hot, like they kind of did with the Royals. If they played the Royals like 2 months before they played them, they probably would have run over them with a, you know, with a steam shovel or whatever. But they didn't. They played them, you know, whatever it was, like 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, when, you know, when the Royals were really going, they were hitting really well. Guys who hadn't been hitting all year were all of a sudden hitting, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's real easy to come down on somebody, you know, like Bradley in this situation. And, you know, we can use this stat to go, okay, this is what has happened. But I don't think you can necessarily use it to say this is what is going to happen.
Well, I'm glad that's true because and I do agree to some extent, and it's certainly not indicative of what will happen in the playoffs, because I just expanded this clutch stat to all the way back to 2010, and mm-hmm. from that time period, David Ortiz ranks last on the Red Sox, number 61 out of all of the players that qualified for this list, with a clutch rating of -3.79. And we know that he has batted about 5,000 in the playoffs.
Although that's probably that's all regular season numbers, what you're talking about, right?
Yes, he is an unclutch guy in the regular season. That is,
Well, that's always been the problem with David Ortiz. He just doesn't get it done when you, when the game's on the line.
Yeah.
I'm going to be glad to see him leave. I think it's about time, you know.
Oh yeah, he's just been a really real blight on this club for a long time. So
hard in the pieces and the whole thing. Anyway,
so yeah, we've just done a really good job of exploding our entire argument into bits and pieces with just that one stat there. So now I feel particularly silly, but either way. Maybe Poppy has really been an unclutch regular season performer. Certainly been the most clutch player pretty much of all time in the postseason, though. So I don't care at all about that.
Yeah, I was gonna say you'll take what you got there. That's a hand you can play.
Yep, exactly. So let's move on from this. We've talked about all this at length. Very interesting stuff there, and I urge everybody who's listening who did enjoy that conversation to go ahead and check out some of those clutch and unclutch stats, because they are kind of fun to play with.
And I, just for the record, I wrote about them at BP Boston on Friday. I wrote about the pitching staff, and I think a couple of weeks before that, I wrote about the Red Sox hitting. And how you know, sort of clutch and unclutch they've been. So you can check those out at our website there as well.
Yeah, and they are really good articles, so I would definitely urge you to check those.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, I like them.
Thank you.
So the Red Sox did make a few September call-ups. The most interesting one by far was calling up Yoan Moncada, who, if you listened to the show last week, I spoke with Matt Collins about at length. I was of the mind that the Red Sox should and probably would call him up to play third base because of how punchless that position has been, with Travis Shaw being really performing well below replacement levels during the second half. So they did go ahead and call up Moncada to provide a little bit of a boost there, and it is he who is going to be getting majority of the starts at third base for the remainder of the season. Shaw has been told this and is now preparing to play some left field. So a little bit interesting there. I think the Red Sox certainly prefer keeping Holt out of left field as much as they can to use him in that more utility role. So not a bad thing for the Red Sox to have Shaw performing or preparing to be able to perform in left field to give them a little bit more flexibility there. But Moncada does add a nice little element to the team. He started off pretty hot. I'm not sure exactly what his average is right now, but he was like 4-for-10 to start his career. Had a rough day yesterday. Definitely has been exposed a little bit against breaking pitches, which I think we know is going to happen, and was replaced versus the lefty by Aaron Hill later in the game. He's going to be the platoon mate for him. So I don't know. I really do like the move, though. I think it was the right thing to do, and even if he is exposed a little bit, he's going to add a few more dynamic elements to the team. What did you think about the promotion?
So It's hard to divorce the idea of it from, you know, what we've seen so far.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say I like that they've called him up. I think he has a role on the team. And I think it'll be good for him to be with the Major League Club, for the remainder of the year. I don't think he starts the year in the majors next year. I think he's probably, in AAA, to start the season. And maybe for a lot of the season, depending on how that goes. So I think that I like him coming up. I don't really like them handing him the third base job as they've done. He's obviously an incredibly talented guy. He's big, he's strong, he's really fast. He is also incredibly new to third base. I mean, he's played it very, very little frequently.
He did play it in his career in Cuba, though.
Yes, he did. He did, which at this point is like 4 years ago. And he played it, six games? I think it was under 10 games in Double A.
Right.
Before they called him up. Now, he's obviously a tremendously physically skilled guy. And so I have no doubt long term that he'll be able to play third base. But this is a pennant race, and the Red Sox are a game out of first place.
But who would you rather them play there? I mean, can you continue to run out Shaw? That was my problem. That was my argument last week, was this guy has been performing pretty much as bad as a player is allowed to perform without being benched, batting like 150 or below.
Yeah.
I mean, even if Moncada does come up and have spells where he's not performing, he literally can't be worse than Travis Shaw is or has been.
So I don't love Shaw. That is true. He's been incredibly streaky, which is probably less than ideal. His defense is maybe a little better than iffy.
It's fundamentally sound, but he can't range to certain plays. There's just plays that he can't make that Moncada can make because of that his athleticism.
That's true. There's also the problem with Moncada in both at second and at third base in Double A has been his propensity to make errors. He's made a lot of errors, and we've already seen that at the major league level.
Yep, he made his first one 2 days ago.
Yep, and so I think I'd rather stick with. Now, I'm not saying don't ever play him, but I think on the whole I'd rather stick with Shaw at third. He's steadier. Now, the other thing about this is, the Red Sox are, hopefully taking into account things like, what's going on behind the scenes. How is Shaw, working, with the hitting coaches, what the hitting coaches think of his approach, the way that they're grading him from a scouting perspective. Maybe he's got some sort of lingering injury, although if they're trying to play him in left field, I probably doubt that. But there's other things that go into it besides just looking at the numbers, is the point. That said, I don't love bringing up a guy who is obviously raw and inexperienced at the position, who's incredibly young, and putting him as the starter at third base in the stretch run of a pennant race. I think you're asking for failure. We've seen guys like Benintendi come up and not be fazed by the bright lights at all. But I have to think that that is abnormal, especially coming up from Double A. That's, you're just asking so much of a young guy in that situation. And I think it's really, really tough. And we talk about, teams putting their players in the best position to succeed. We were going to talk about Ziegler and the way that he, he's a righty? He's a right-hander, right?
Yep, Ziegler's a righty.
Yeah, so his trouble is getting lefties out.
Right.
And throughout his career, that's been a problem because of the way he pitches. I mean, this is kind of like, you know, Justin Masterson all over again in that sense. You know, when you come around the side like that, that's just sort of the way things go, because on the other side, you get this really good look at the ball. And so, you know, it's incumbent on John Farrell to minimize the number of lefties that Ziegler sees. Now, he's going to see some, but you don't want it to be the majority or anywhere close to it. A smart manager is going to, you know, give his, you know, put his players in a position to get the outs. And I think the same idea applies here. You know, Moncada, he could be amazing right now, immediately. But what we've seen so far has certainly not been amazing. He struck out over 40% of the time. He was picked off the other day at first base. He doesn't hit the ball in the air at all, really. He's made errors at third base. And that's not to say that he's going to continue to do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if he did, would you?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he continues to have, you know, an occasional error or a base running blunder. But I would be surprised, very much so, if what he gives you offensively as a whole is not better than what you've been getting from Travis Shaw over the last 2 months. And I think what you also need to look at here is what this allows the Red Sox to do is not only platoon Moncada with Hill, with Moncada going against righties and Hill going against lefties there to protect him against that weakness and still give him reps almost every single day. This also allows Shaw to move out to the outfield and platoon him with Chris Young, who's just a lefty masher. And Shaw, even despite all the troubles he's had, has been pretty decent against right-handed pitching, batting .266 against them on the season.
Wait. You can't say Shaw's good against righties and he should be playing in left field, but that he's no good and he's shouldn't be playing at third base.
What I'm saying is this gives you two platoon situations that you can now play guys a little bit less than you normally would going down the stretch. And I just don't know. I don't know what exactly you're worried about Moncada that you wouldn't be worried about with Shaw in that situation. You say you're worried about him out there, but how can it be worse than what we're getting?
Well, we've seen Travis Shaw be a good major league hitter. Right. And I'm not putting money down on the fact that he's going to be an all-star going forward, but we have seen it happen. You know, We've never seen Yoan Moncada be a good major league hitter. We have seen Yoan Moncada be a very impressive double-A player with still, even that said, with holes in his game, both defensively and offensively. And, you know, people compare him to Benintendi. Benintendi didn't have any holes in his game in double-A. I mean, he had none.
Right.
He hit for power, he hit for average, he fielded the ball well both in left field and in center. You know, he was smart on the bases. That there was nothing left for him to learn in at double A and not really in the minors. So I think it was a reasonable thing to be aggressive and pull him up like that, and I really like that move. And this is not that. This is something different. Now I recognize there, you know, there's a hole on the team based on Shaw's, you know, production. But again, I don't know that you can look at what Shaw's done over the last month and go, he's going to do that guaranteed over the next month. I guess I would say this, even if you could tell me, okay, Shaw's going to hit 210, 280, 390 over the next, you know, whatever it is, 30 games that are left. Yeah. I think I would still start him the whole time.
So my problem with that is that when we were talking about this, you said yourself there's at least a possibility that Moncada can come up and be awesome right away, because he did show that when he came up from Salem and he came up to Portland, he was awesome right away. And that's a huge jump in its own right. I don't think that you can honestly say that there's any possibility, and certainly not more possibility, that Travis Shaw is awesome from here on out than there is with Yoan Moncada. And I think that potential alone is why Farrell decided to make the move.
But here's the thing, and I agree, that's why he did. I think it's an indictment of Shaw more than it is anything else. I think the Red Sox don't think Shaw is going to be hitting anymore. And so that's certainly a more legitimate opinion than mine. But you asked for my opinion, so I'm giving you mine.
Sure.
I would say that the reason I would play Shaw most of the time, and again, not all the time, is found in looking at the Red Sox lineup. The Red Sox have scored the most runs in baseball. They have an incredibly deep lineup. They can have a guy who is, you know, a subcompetent major league hitter who has maybe a higher floor than a flashy double-A prospect, right? You can afford to play Travis Shaw when you've got, you know, Bogarts and Betts and Ramirez and Bradley and Ortiz and Pedroia.
But I don't know that he has a higher floor anymore.
Okay.
He's batted 202 in the second half.
No, I know. I know he has. I know. It's been – but he also batted much better than that in the first half, right?
Right.
I mean, so, you know, again, that's – in the second half, he's at 203, 277, 407. That's a fine slugging percentage. It's a bad on-base percentage. I would probably say that, you know, what you could expect from Shaw over the next month is probably better than that, but not a lot better. But I think the downside of playing Moncada is much higher. I think you're putting him in a position where he can make a lot of mental mistakes. He can, you know, scar himself, you know, in a way that prospects can.
Right.
And I think that the chances of him being worse and you damaging one of your long-term assets exist where it doesn't exist with playing Travis Shaw, who is going to give you, you know, probably kind of a crappy but workmanlike performance, and you can stick him in the back of the lineup and pinch hit for him at the end of the game, and it's not going to crush you because your lineup is so strong.
See, I just don't buy that there's any potential about damaging Moncada here. First of all, like, we don't know what his makeup is. Like, maybe he's the type of guy that can go up and handle this. He seemed extremely focused throughout the short time that he's been here with the team. And then the other thing is, right now, I mean, seasons are winding down in the minor leagues. This is giving him more reps to help him prepare for next year and to expose him initially to this pitching. So would we rather have him called up and sitting on the bench and playing like once every 6 days? Or rather see him actually getting reps? And I would rather see him actually getting reps.
Well, so I don't give a crap about him getting reps at this point. I care about this team winning baseball games. And I think that's where the Red Sox priorities need to be. I mean, you're right. The minor league season is wrapping up, almost done. You know, he's had a full season out of it. He's probably going to play in the Arizona Fall League. And he'll get even more reps there. Calling him up was, I agree, I think the right thing to do. It's good to have him around the major league team. It's good to, you know, have him hang out with David Ortiz as much as possible. I think it can only help him long term. It can only help the team long term. My issue is handing him the third base job when he doesn't appear to be ready. I say he doesn't appear to be based on scouting reports from his time in AA, as well as what I've seen in the majors. But again, you know, the Red Sox presumably have taken all that into account and have aren't making a panicky move based on, a couple months of lousy Travis Shaw. So Well, this we'll see what happens.
It sparked a good unexpected debate, that's for sure. This was one of the most innocuous topics that I think I put on here, and it sparked a good 20-minute debate. So,
gonna love having Moncada called up.
Yeah, I thought you were gonna go along with it, but I'm happy to that we got both sides of that, because I think that there certainly is an argument to be made for both sides, and we spelled that out here for a long time, so that's good.
Yeah, I love watching him. I mean, if this team were out of it, heck yeah, give him the starting third base job. I'd be all for it. But you know, they're a game out of first place, and the Blue Jays keep losing. I mean, they've got to take advantage of their opportunities, and it's going to be hard when you know Moncada's getting picked off first base and overthrowing a first base or letting a ball go through his legs at third because he's just not experienced there. So anyway, we've all made these points, and you tried to wrap up and I went back to it, so I apologize.
That's okay. When he hits 250 and doesn't expose himself on the base paths and the Red Sox win the division, I'll accept your apology.
Man, you'll get it. I will be very happy. I hope that's what happens.
All right, so let's touch on a few extra things here before we go ahead and wrap up, because we are starting to run long. I wanted to talk about one thing that was perplexing with the pen use again. No Brad Ziegler last night in the eighth inning. They had double barrel action in the bullpen warming up. It was Matt Barnes and Joe Kelly. Joe Kelly got the nod instead of Brad Ziegler there, who wasn't even a consideration, even though he was presumably available. Kelly did come on to pitch a great eighth and looked awesome, but my question is here, why is there no use of Ziegler here still in these key situations? Because by a lot of the metrics out there, and really just by past performance and skill level and all that stuff, Ziegler is your second best reliever on this team. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me why he's not getting used very much. And I know he had the flu, but that's over.
Yeah. So I'm trying to look up the batters in. So Sardinas was leading off the eighth, and he's a switch hitter. I don't know if he's better from one side or the other. I'm not getting that deep into it. Will Myers, who is probably the Padres' best hitter, was next. And then Solarte, who has had a kind of a good season, sort of shockingly.
Isn't he a switch hitter too?
He's a switch hitter too. So I think if you're putting Ziegler in, you're asking him to get two lefties out. And so that's my guess as to why they didn't.
But you're also warming two other righties, so...
Yes, potentially not with the same platoon split issues as Ziegler. I mean, Ziegler obviously is a really good pitcher against righties, not so good against lefties, as we've seen. Let's see, where is it here?
This then just plays into, again, the team with no roles in the back of their bullpen, though, because I see that they're – the platoon thing might be an issue, but there certainly is a whole lot to the fact that teams that seem to have successful bullpens have bullpen arms that know that they own particular innings. And yeah. That continues not to be a theme on the Red Sox.
No, that's true. And what I would say is installing Ziegler as the eighth inning guy would be a move of desperation, not one that you would look at the numbers, look at the, you know, the way the pitches are thrown. Look at the, you know, watch the games. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put those two things together and go, Brad Ziegler should be the eighth inning guy for the Red Sox. I think the problem with the Red Sox has been, you know, bullpen has been injuries. Those maybe were predictable on some level. And, you know, they just haven't had the performance from those other guys, behind those injured guys to step up and, you know, and pitch as well as the team has needed. But if you look at Ziegler this year, against left-handers, he is a K9 of 518 and a walk nine of 555. He's walking more lefties than he is striking out.
Right. Certainly a bad performance so far this season.
It's really bad. Yeah. But if you look at how he's done against righties, and not that these are the best stats, these just happen to be the ones that are right in front of me, so forgive me for that. But he's striking out over nine guys per game versus righties, and under two walks per nine against righties. So it's a much, much different he's a much different pitcher against right-handers, and you really don't want him to be facing lefties and bringing him into a situation where he's going to gonna pitch against two left-handed batters out of three. And I didn't even look who's coming after Solarte. I don't know. But it doesn't even make a difference. Putting him there in that situation, I think, is asking for failure. If you do that, you're potentially turning a 2-1 game into a 3-1 or 4-1 game.
That's a fair argument. I think the counter argument there, though, is that those two potential left-handed guys are Sardinas and Solarte. They're not Will Myers, who's the guy that you're really worried about hurting you in those situations. And I know Solarte's had himself a decent little season, but we're not talking about Babe Ruth here going up against you. So.
Although I would say that the guy who hit the two-run homer is Adam Rosales, who kind of sucks. So, you can be hurt in that situation.
Sure. Any guy in the major leagues can hurt you in that situation.
And the other part of this, I think, is not to belabor this point, but it is that I think the Red Sox are searching for somebody to step up and be that eighth inning guy. And so I think that's why you saw Joe Kelly. Kelly, you spent a lot of time in the minors this year. Some of it has been good. Some of it has not been. But there's been some scouting talk about how he's done something different with his fastball, and he's got a little more movement on it now.
He's been pitching it up in the zone a lot more, which is and he did last night as well. I certainly noticed that, and it looked very effective. He got two strikeouts on that. So we'll see how that develops. But, I think it's a good thing that we saw him again post this resurgence that he had in Pawtucket. It's still going to be difficult to trust him unless we see this happen about 10 more times.
Well, and that's exactly what I think the Red Sox are going to try to do. I mean, yeah. I think you're going to start to see Joe Kelly inserted into game situations like that. They're going to give him a chance to succeed in those situations because nobody else really has.
Well, liquor sales in New England just went up in the late innings, so that'll be a lot of fun.
It's been a garbage pail for the for the bullpen this year. Even the closer. I don't know about you, but I see Kimbrel come in and I get a lump in my throat.
I don't feel good about it. I got to say, for how effective he's been, I don't feel good about it a lot of times.
And this goes back to, sort of the problem with trading for relievers and giving relievers long-term contracts. There's just so few relievers who are really worth that. Even the guys who are completely dominant one year are just not.
I know you hate that trade, Matt, but we cannot spend any time on that today.
Okay. Moving on. I hate that trade. Done.
I know. You really hate that trade. A couple more things to close out. We are having Koji Uehara activated. He was activated 2 days ago. As you listen to this, he will be pitched in low leverage situations before he sees any sort of impact in the later innings. I think this can only be a good thing for the pen. Heath Embry also going to be a factor in the pen as the season wraps up. He's very good against right-handers, so I'm happy to see that.
Can I make a quick comment on Koji?
Yes.
Nope. That's not the one I wanted to make. This is supposed to be clapping.
Oh.
I've got a little sound effects thing here.
Interesting.
It's supposed to clap. I think it's broken. Nope, it's broken. All right, whatever. Done.
Well, we've gotten some innocuous noise from Matt about Uehara. So
I'm happy Koji's back.
Okay, yeah, me too. He gives great high fives. Steven Wright still dealing with some soreness, so Buchholz gets the start tonight. I feel good about this, and I'm not sure why, but Buchholz been pitching pretty well. He faces off against Clemens in the second game of this series at San Diego. Not the good Clemens. This Clemens is particularly bad. Then we have David Price versus Jared Cosart. Two pitching advantages for the Red Sox there. They get an off day as they travel back to the East Coast, where they will face against Toronto, presumably for the lead in the division there, where we will see Porcello versus Estrada, Eddie versus J.A. Happ, Drew Pomeranz versus R.A. Dickey. Three matchups that I think the Red Sox have a pretty good shot at, and this is going to be some pretty good baseball over the next week.
Yeah, it should be exciting. The the Jays are, I think, if it's not the Red Sox, I think the Blue Jays are the best team in the American League. I think you could make an argument for the Red Sox, but I think as far as all the teams they'll be playing down the stretch, people have been saying it's going to be really tough, and I think it will be tough. I think primarily it'll be really tough because they'll be on the road a lot. But they're gonna face off against the Blue Jays six times.
Yeah, they close the season. Blue Jays at home as well.
Right. Okay. I think those are gonna be huge games. Definitely. R.A. Dickey's looked really hittable. I think he got beat up yesterday. Not actually, which is good. But he gave up a lot of hits and runs, which is also good. So I think a lot of the Blue Jays, starters who have maybe overperformed a little bit, Happ and Estrada have not looked nearly as good recently. And so I feel like we could be catching the Blue Jays at sort of the proverbial good time.
It does seem that way. And Jose Bautista has not been quite himself either.
No, he hasn't. So I think this is, and they've lost a number of games recently. They've not the Red Sox have certainly haven't been dominant either. Other than against, those two games against the A's, winning 16-2, 11-2, and then losing 1-0 in a game where you had, oh my God. Anyway. So those are going to be, kind of playoff games. I'm really excited to see them. And I think the Red Sox have a good shot in those. And this would be a good time for the Red Sox to kind of get out of their, unclutchy kind of rut that they've been in most of the season. It'd be nice to get some clutch hits and some clutch pitching and win some ball games there.
Yeah, it really would. And this will wrap up their time on the road, and then they come back home for a four-game set against Baltimore. So this is certainly
three against Baltimore.
Three against
the Yankees.
Yep. So a very important time for them to do well. I don't see a single matchup here where I feel like the Red Sox have a disadvantage. So I think that's a good thing from the pitching side. And hopefully the back end of the bullpen can at least hold up some of their side of the bargain here. So that pretty much does it for our show today. So you can go ahead and follow us on iTunes if you would like to subscribe. You can do that there. You can also subscribe to us on Stitcher. And you can rate and review us on both places. Again, if you have any questions that you'd like to appear on the show, you can submit those to us via a question box on bpboston.com. Could just click on any of our podcasts. You'll find that there. You can follow me on Twitter at DevJake, and you can follow Matt on Twitter at MattyMatty2000. And hopefully by the time we're back with you next, the Red Sox will have finally wrested control of that number one spot in the division. So here's to that, and thank you so much for joining us today, Matt. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jake. And I look forward to talking to you about the playoffs next time I'm on.
All right, sounds good.